Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, listening into the Wise Women Media, the radio show on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Anita Stewart, and we have interesting topics, and just remember, this is just a conversation. I wanted to note our sponsors, which are Roundtree 7, Here Be Monsters, Daughters of Isis, The Hoodooed Blog, Power New Media and Public Relations, Tarot and Stars, Florida Nature Photos, And I also want to invite you all to check us out on the web at wisewomenmedia.posteris.com and hit us up at the WePay link so we can keep the show on the air every week. This date is significant because everything is relative, but December 7th marks the Memorial Day of the attack on Pearl Harbor, which was the incident that really got the United States involved in the Second World War. There's a lot of theories as to why that happened and how that happened and how it probably was World War II's 9-1-1 incident. But what was significant that happened afterwards, of course, was not only the United States becoming involved in the Second World War, but some of the first uses of nuclear energy, but in a very malefic way by our military bombing Nagasaki and Hiroshima later on during the war in August of 1945. So we are going to talk tonight about how nuclear energy is being used as a power source and how that is probably definitely not a good idea. We have a special guest with us from the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, or SACE, S-A-C-E, Mandy Hancock, who's the high-risk energy organizer. And are you on the air with us, Mandy?
I am, Anita. Hi, how are you?
Well, great, and thanks for being on the show tonight. I wanted you to maybe start out about telling us a little bit about how you got involved in regards to your advocacy against nuclear energy and how you got this position and exactly what this position entails. So I'm going to give you the...
Okay. Well, I got involved in advocacy and activism and energy work while I was on campus at Valdosta State University in South Georgia. And I got involved with the Southern Energy Network, which is SACE's campus program. And I was there, just a volunteer for a while and organizing on campus. And once I graduated, I went after their Florida organizer position. And when I got that position, I sort of inherited the nuclear issue. And I didn't at that time know very much about it. I had seen a talk by Mary Olson in South Carolina at the Southeast Student Renewable Energy Conference, and she had this big map that had all of the nuclear stuff that was going on in the United States, including all of the reactors that were operating and all of the ones that were proposed and all of the waste sites, and I just saw the Southeast, my home region, smothered in nuclear mess is basically how I saw it. And so I was interested in the issue, but I didn't really have a strong connection at that time. I wasn't even aware that they were proposing to build two new ones in Georgia at that time, you know. And when I moved to Florida to take on my new role as the Florida organizer, I sort of inherited the issue. Some students and Mary Olson had already started a sort of statewide loosely associated network of people that were discussing what was happening at the state level, and I started facilitating that conversation and then just decided I would really rather focus just on nuclear work because I was doing a lot of student organizing at the time that had me doing much larger national type campaigns. And I talked to some folks and we all worked it out and we carved out a part-time position for me to just work on nuclear, and it slowly built up to almost full-time so that I can spend a lot of time working on Florida, but I also do some work in Georgia and Tennessee, and I do some liaison work in the Carolinas as far as keeping them up with what's happening in Florida, and it's really interesting, keeps me on my toes.
Well, that's great that you were able to actually put that position together, but definitely it's an information source, and it's definitely a powerhouse for getting information out there to the activist community, because we can certainly talk about how the media hides a lot of these facts about nuclear energy and nuclear power, and how really the masses have been just cajoled into believing that it's a veritable form of energy, it's legitimate, it's safe, it's clean. And as you and I know, that nothing could be further from the truth. And just
right.
So the audience knows, Mandy and I met each other with Mary Olson from NERS at a teach-in. I think we were up in Marion County, weren't we? It was back a couple winters ago.
We were out in the woods somewhere.
very near
the proposed Levy County site. We were and we were at the edge of a couple of county boundaries. I believe that it was very close to the proposed Levy site in Georgia, in Florida.
And nothing could have been more pristine being out there. I mean, to think that if we had been out there and it had been later in time, or you know, situation had been different in a nuclear power plant could have been maybe just a few miles away. It would have been really, really a horrible thing to think about. So, but I was able to learn a lot on that particular weekend. Tell us a little bit about what's happening with the Levy County plant, because I think a lot of people want to hear about that, and I really do feel that a lot of the facts are covered up. So give us a little information, especially about how we can follow the money trail to find out what's really going on.
Well, that is a little trickier, especially with the merger with Progress Energy and Duke Energy. It's a little bit trickier to follow the money, and I guess we're still kind of looking to see what's going to happen with some of the recent developments with that situation. I can say that North Carolina has been a lot more on the tail of this Duke Progress Energy merger situation than the Florida Commission has been following it. But with the Levy reactors, so there's several things that are unique about the Levy County situation. And one is that they are proposed to be built on a greenfield site. Any of the other new reactor proposals in the country are all proposed in existing reactor sites. And so this is a very ecologically sensitive area that we're talking about. It's right by the Gothy National Forest, and it's sitting over the top of an aquifer that supplies the water to a lot of the beautiful springs in our part of the state. And it's just a very ecologically sensitive area. And so the Mary Olson and Nuclear Information Resource Service and the Ecology Party of Florida banded together to intervene on the license for the Levy reactors. And it's a long, drawn-out, convoluted process with the regulatory body, sort of like dealing with any bureaucracy. It takes a long, long time for anything to happen. So that process has been going on since 2009, and we just recently had another hearing in Bronson, Florida, at the Levy County Courthouse, and we got to hear the geologists from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the geologists from that were hired by the interveners discussing some of the primary concerns that were actually accepted by the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board as being relevant and significant enough to hold the proceedings and to examine further. And that's basically a water contention that deals with the water quality and quantity in the area. Since there are a lot of wetlands in the area, Dr. Sidney Backus is the intervener's expert, and she did all of her doctoral dissertation work on the wetlands in that very specific area that they're talking about building the nuclear reactors. And what she found was that there was a lot of opportunity for the drawback from the water that they want to pull from the aquifer to damage those wetlands, and that's obviously a problem because wetlands are protected for very good reason, and in Florida we have a very long history of what can go wrong when you don't protect the wetlands as you should. So it's a big deal. And what we found through those proceedings was that the research that was done wasn't really done in the area where they want to build the wells and draw the water out of the aquifer. They just looked at what would happen at the area basically where the nuclear reactors were going to be. They call it the nuclear island. So we went through this long two-day proceeding basically to find out that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff had just used a model and extrapolated some data and then used that modeling to determine what would happen in that area without actually drawing any core samples or any real tangible physical data from the area. And my favorite part of that proceeding was when the presiding judge, Carlin, said, well, is it better to have information from a model or is it better to have information from real life? And they got a chuckle out of the people in the courtroom, but it's really not funny because the truth of the matter is that real life data is something that you can't replace with a model. And all of the information that they were using to base their decisions on were based on a model that had been edited and reevaluated and recalibrated a couple of times because it wasn't up to snuff even for the NRC. So it's a really tricky thing. It's hard to really package up in a neat nutshell, but the long and the short of it is I think that we won that case in front of the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, but it'll be obviously up to them to make the decision as to whether or not our case was strong enough to make the NRC go back and redo that portion of the environmental impact statement. Other than that, with the Levy reactors, that's really the only thing happening on the legal side to prevent it other than the stuff that's happening at the state level with the nuclear cost recovery legislation.
You talk about the environmental impact statement, and of course it is theories, but it reminds me of what they did during the Gulf oil spill when they simply pulled something from that they had after the Exxon Valdez disaster, and they used this, you know, huge document, which was an environmental impact statement for, of course, you know, Alaska, and mm-hmm. what was they were applying it to the Gulf of Mexico, and then somebody noticed on page 500 or whatever, there was a listing of animals, and of course, walrus were included. It was like,
oh, goodness.
Wait a minute. This is not the environmental impact statement for the Gulf of Mexico. It can't be. So,
oh,
you know, they're, like you said, they extrapolate data that may or may not apply to what they're actually dealing with at the time. It's really crazy. But tell us a little bit about the cost and the recovery and the money and how that is coming into play now. Because that's the big thing in the nutshell here.
Yeah, and that is the thing that is getting the most attention. And the cost is, the short way to say it is the cost is exorbitant, and it certainly is. When they initially proposed the reactors, they were proposed to cost about half what they're proposed to cost now, and they were supposed to come online in the late 2010s, and now they've been pushed out to the late 2020s. And so essentially back in 2006, the state legislature passed an energy bill that had this sneaky little amendment in it that became the basis for this nuclear cost recovery legislation. And we call it the nuclear tax because that's essentially what it is a tax that's being levied by Progress Energy and Florida Power and Light to subsidize the costs that they're putting into these nuclear projects. And the reason they're doing that is because it makes good business sense, because right now the Wall Street and the investors, they know that these are very risky business decisions, and they won't really touch them. We always say Wall Street won't touch it, and that's true. They won't finance these type projects because the risk of them defaulting is really high. And so the only way that the utilities can make these nuclear projects a feasible reality is to subsidize all of the risk onto their customers. And so basically what they're doing is privatizing the profit and socializing the risk. And so ever since 2009, when the first nuclear cost recovery increase was actually began on the bills, Progress Energy customers and Florida Power and Light customers have been paying money for new nuclear reactors. For Progress, part of that money went towards Crystal River because it was supposed to be an uprate.
Right.
But I believe that I'm not sure how much of the money went towards Crystal River, and obviously we can get into a little bit of that mess, but they're not getting any bang for that buck because that reactor's been broken for 3 years. So far they've been approved for over $1 billion. The Public Service Commission just, and that's both of the utilities, Progress and Florida Power and Light, the Public Service Commission just approved another $292 million. So that brings a total up to almost $1.3 billion that has been approved for these projects that may or may not ever happen. And if these reactors are never built, the customers don't get a refund. So it's a very tricky spot for the consumers to be in, that's for sure.
And some of the customers, I mean, when you look at it in that regard, some of those customers will be dead. So they'll never even...
Absolutely. And that point has been made multiple times. I've heard it being made at the Public Service Commission. There's been some mention of it when we were at the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board hearing. It was interesting that the topic came up because really it was outside of the scope of what that hearing was about, but it was brought up. And they discuss it as sort of like an intergenerational burden. And some people say, well, you know, of course that's how it is. You know, people pay taxes for roads that they're not ever going to drive on. You know, that's how it works. But that is a little bit different. There's something that is actually promised to come into fruition from that money, whereas in this situation, it's a corporate project that doesn't have any guarantees. So, you know, it doesn't really matter how you package it. It's not a good deal for Florida consumers. And what it really does is it creates an unlevel playing field where real solutions to our energy problems can't be pursued because all of our time and money is being wrapped up in these big, expensive, complicated nuclear projects, and we're ignoring some of the low-hanging fruit that's right in front of us, which is increasing our efficiency and exploring renewable projects, perhaps going for some solar in the Sunshine State. It sounds so nice. It rolls off the tongue very well.
Yeah, and it makes perfect sense that if we're called the Sunshine State, that we would utilize the power that's the most abundant here. You know, I mean, I'm looking and we have some people in the chat room, and I'm hoping that any of you, if you've got any questions, just dash them off there in the chat room. And also, if you prefer to call and ask Mandy any questions, our call-in number is 213-816-0357. I wanted to talk about, you know, you can take this a step further, and I wanted to make this point before we go further, or I'm going to forget it. Our leaders vote on this. Our power companies have basically usurped their power. So we, the people that are paying these power bills, are paying a tax without representation. We are being taxed without representation for a service that we may or may not see in the future. So I'm not understanding, and I cannot quite wrap my mind around the fact that people are not enraged over this. I mean, this is something that people should just be in the streets over.
Well, there's certainly more upset about it than they were in the past. When I first started doing this in 08, you know, when you'd see an article come out they were never very hard hitting, and the comments were, well, we need nuclear because coal is bad, and, you know, the analysis just really wasn't very deep. And I can say that in the 4 years since that, you know, you see where there may have been 3 comments before, now there's 47 comments and people are outraged. It's maybe not always enough to get them to take to the streets, but I think it did have people really tuning in to the Public Service Commission hearings this year and tuning in to the Supreme Court case that SACE is involved in, where we're challenging the constitutionality of this this legislation because it is an unfair tax. And basically the part of the meat, let's say, of that sort, that case is basically that the legislature is given the Public Service Commission unbridled discretion to make these decisions without really giving them the definitions they need to make smart decisions. So the law basically says, oh, well, they can recover prudently incurred costs, but there's no definition of what prudent is. There's no real there's not the same standard that is usually applied in rate cases is not being applied here, and most rate cases are subject to public commenting and that sort of thing, whereas these rate cases are not. The public can go and they can watch the proceedings, but they aren't able to make any comments except via online, and who knows where those things go. They get put on in a file that's really difficult to find on the PSC website, but I think that's where they go to just collect dust. I'm unsure if anyone ever sees them again. So I wanted to pull out just a little. I'm sorry, Anita.
They need a letter, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to pull out a piece of what you said, how this happens with the money and the power, and then the people just basically are getting the raw end of the deal. So after the public service, after the Supreme Court case hearings, they heard oral arguments at the beginning of October, and that following weekend, the Southeastern Renewable Energy Conference that I referenced earlier, which is where I initially got my exposure to the nuclear issue, was hosted in Tallahassee. And so part of the conference always involves an action component. And their messaging this year was getting dirty politics out of money, getting dirty politics. That was the Freudian slip, getting dirty money out of politics and cleaning up the dirty South. And they were using the nuclear cost recovery issue as the local example of what can go wrong when dirty money is influencing the politics, because basically the utilities had all these lobbyists. I can't even remember how many it was per legislator in Florida, and they just flooded Tallahassee with all this money, and they wanted this bill to be owned. We need to diversify our portfolio, and we need fuel diversification and energy independence and all of this stuff, and they made it sound like we needed it, and we're going to run out of power and all of this stuff. And so the amendment got snuck in. Nobody really asked any questions, and as soon as people realized what happened, you know, everybody voted for it. There was only one person that voted against it, and she said, I can't remember her name right now, which is very unfortunate. I'd love to give her credit. She said the reason she voted against it is because she read the bill, and it was horrible, you know. So that's what happens when dirty money influences politics. And then you see years later, the people are finally waking up to what's happening and the fact that their bills are only going to continue to go up, and they're going to be stuck footing the bill for these phantom, I've been calling them phantom nuclear reactors, because we don't really know if they'll ever exist.
Right. I call all money in politics dirty. I think it's all dirty because, of course, I've support Move to Amend and the abolishment, you know, complete abolishment of corporate personhood. And I think as soon as we take the ability of our legislators to be bought away from them, then we'll have some true representation. But right now we don't have it. And like you said, most of our legislators do not read the bills. The lobbyists write them, and the legislatures might scan them or have their assistants scan them, and then they sign off on them before even realizing what they say. So they are completely bought and paid for by the corporations, and until we can divide those two, we're just going to have more and more of this. I wanted to note a most recent article about the Levy County situation. It was an article that came out in the Tampa Bay Times. Have you read this, Mandy? It's called Florida House Representative Files Bill to Repeal Advance Fee for Building Nuclear Plants. It just came out yesterday.
This with Ray Winkle-Vasalinda, right?
That's it. Yes, that's it. She's listed here. It says State Representative Michelle Rawinkle-Vasalinda, Democrat from Tallahassee, who described the advance fee as an unfair tax, in quotes, said a growing coalition of lawmakers support the bill she filed. So great. So maybe she's actually passing it around and getting people, you know, getting other lawmakers to actually, you know, support it. But in any case, I have posted that link under our blog post at Wise Women Media. So anybody that wants to go directly to that link, it's at the very bottom. So now that we've kind of discussed in short a little bit about Levy County, give us a just a little rundown on what you know about Crystal River, which is really closer to Tampa and really, I think it really puts us under the gun, especially if there's ever a hurricane. But tell us a little bit about Crystal River and where we're at with that. It's broken, but a lot of people might not even know that it's broken and not functional.
Well, it's been broken for 3 years, and so Progress Energy wanted to do what Florida Power and Light did with St. Lucie. They uprated it so that it would put out more power than it already was already producing. And so what they did is they hired an outside firm and went against some advice that they had to perhaps consult with someone who had done this type of project before and to not do it themselves. And they did it themselves anyway and went against their engineering consultant's advice and started deconstructing the containment unit in such a way that they had been made aware that this was a dangerous way to deconstruct the containment building to get in there and replace the steam generator to upgrade it. And they did it exactly the opposite of the way they were told to do it, and they broke it. And the first few media pieces seemed to allude that they found these cracks, what they called delamination. You know, they like to use euphemistic language so people don't really know what's happening, because cracks in a nuclear containment vessel sounds way worse than delamination, which no one really even knows what that means. And so they broke it, and they say that the work that they did is what created the cracks. It's hard to say. The cracks could have already been there. They wouldn't know because they couldn't see it. So they went in to fix it, and it happened again, and they went in to fix it, happened again. So basically they've broken it 3 times, and it's rapidly coming up close to Three Mile Island as being one of the most expensive nuclear accidents in the U.S. The difference, of course, here is that no radiation was released, whereas in Three Mile Island there was. So customers were on the hook for hundreds of millions of dollars in replaced fuel charges because Progress was having to import energy in from other places in the grid to make up for that loss. Their customers did get most of that money back earlier this year with the stipulation that Progress Energy had to make a decision as to whether or not they were going to fix Crystal River or not, and they were supposed to make that decision by the end of the year. So it's rapidly running out, and they may be due to give another refund to their customers, or perhaps that just happened last week. I know they did reach another settlement agreement, and I think it was related to Crystal River. The long and the short of it is that we've been calling it the Humpty Dumpty reactor because they it's fallen apart, and they just can't seem to put it back together again. It doesn't matter how much money they throw at it. Right now, estimates are that it will be $3 billion in the end to get it operating again, and that's about how much the thing cost to begin with. So $3 billion to get a really old reactor that's nearing the end of its license working again. Doesn't seem like a very smart investment, but we'll see what Duke/Progress decides to do with that.
Now, one of the most recent articles that came out about that was December 1st, and it came out in TBO.com, and the title of it was Fasano, who is a local legislator, Fasano critical of nuclear power fee. And the caption under the picture on that article, again, I'll post the link under the blog post for this show. It says, Progress Energy customers pay an extra $1.93 on monthly bills for a nuclear fee that was approved by the legislature in 2006. The fee was implemented to collect $142 million to help fund the Crystal River and proposed Levy County nuclear power plants shown in a rendering above. So this is still an ongoing story, and of course this I'm just scanning through this article here, and it's talking a little bit about the money and what Progress Energy customers are paying. There's a quote here by Fasano who says, it's a joke. He said they make money whether they build nuclear power plants or not. And he said, Fasano argues that company stockholders should bear development expenses, not customers, before a plant goes into operation. And then the article does end with exactly what you said, Mandy, that, you know, the end of this license will be December of 2016, and it's a 35-year-old nuclear reactor. So, why can't it be out with the old and in with the new? And that's the real question here.
That's a good question. And they'll face a little bit more trouble than a lot of the other relicensing reactors have faced. So far, it's been like a rubber stamp. Every reactor that puts in for a license extension gets 20 years. Okay, there you go. Here's another 20 years to run your reactor. And very often, right after they get approved, something happens, like when Oyster Creek is one of the oldest operating reactors, and that's up in New Jersey. Right after they approved its relicensing was when they found tritium leaking out of it. Right before the Vermont Yankee reactor was relicensed, they found tritium leaking under it. And now that state is being sued by an out-of-town nuclear operator or out-of-state nuclear operator because the state ruled it's one of the only states that has the authority to deny a operator the right to operate in their state. And so this Louisiana-based utility is suing the state of Vermont because Vermont says, no, you can't operate the reactor, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission says, sure, you can. But Vermont says, no, you guys lied to us. You know, there's no way we're going to let you continue to operate this reactor when you've been threatening our drinking water and all this kind of stuff. So the relicensing situation has been interesting to watch. But ever since the waste confidence ruling happened, I'm not sure if you have been following that, but that's going to grind the gears to a halt as far as relicensing and licensing activities go.
There's a question in the chat room which is kind of interesting, and actually the question comes from my sister, and she says, I work for independent supply companies that buy energy for deregulated utilities in 11 states. What about them? I'm not sure what she means specifically, but maybe you know.
Well, I don't know what she means. I can say that some of the deregulated utilities are buying into these projects. So Jacksonville Electric is buying into, I think, Turkey Point and the Vogtle reactors in Georgia. And in Georgia, there's a nuclear energy consortium sort of that's formed with Southern Company, which is Georgia Power, and some of the smaller municipal utilities have joined together. And so it really just depends on the state how those guys factor in. In Florida, so far, Progress Energy has not found any partners, and I think that I'm not sure who all is buying into the Turkey Point project yet, because it's not really as far along as the Levy County project. They haven't really done a whole lot on the Turkey Point licensing yet. So without knowing what she means specifically as far as what about those guys, I don't really know
she
what
else. She said
they,
do. They are brokers that buy energy for the utilities.
Mm-hmm.
So my sister actually works in a call center, so that's what she's doing on the phone, is she's working those little things for the dealers, the brokers, I guess. So there you go.
Well, folks like her are helping Progress Energy keep the lights on in their territory with the fact that Crystal River Light is down, because that's what Progress has been having to do, is buy power from other utilities, and so I'm sure that they're working through folks like your sister to make that happen.
So it's like a reselling back and forth, basically. It's just
mm-hmm.
a re-slamming. Remember back in the day when you'd telemarket, if you were telemarketing, you'd be calling and slamming people for phone service, and they were just yanking service back and forth from this carrier to the next carrier to the next carrier, and it would go on and on. So I guess this is pretty much the same thing. So,
well, it's more of a, like, if they have excess power, who are they going to sell it to? And if they're lacking power, who are they going to buy it from? So it's sort of, you know, making up where they need extra and then selling off where they're producing extra. And I'm sure that they have to negotiate that, to who's going to get that extra, who's going to supply where there's a lack in energy.
And I keep thinking about right before the housing bubble, how everybody was flipping houses. And basically, it's the same principle. So tell me a little bit about Turkey Point. That is interesting to me, and I will tell you why that location is interesting to me. I have an old article from a Miami Herald, which shows after Hurricane Andrew, one of the stacks coming down, being intentionally pulled down, and it sustained millions and millions of dollars worth of damages. Yet people insisted during that time after Andrew, and well, during the storm itself and afterwards, that there was no radiation release. And frankly, I kind of find that hard to believe if one smoke stack was actually intentionally pulled and millions were spent in redoing it. So tell us a little bit about what's happening with Turkey Point, if you have any, you know, information on it.
Sure. FACE is actually one of the intervening parties on that license, so we're intervening in the licensing of that reactor. I'm not familiar. I don't know right now where we stand as far as what contentions may have been submitted or not, so I can't give an update in that regard. But I can say that it may not be on a greenfield site like Levy is, but that doesn't mean it's any less of a mess, because this will be Turkey Point 6 and 7, which means there's already 5 power generating units at that site. Two of them are nuclear reactors, and there's some coal and combined cycle happening down there. And it's situated right in between Biscayne Bay and the Everglades, which are two national parks, the Everglades being one of the most expensive restoration projects that's ever happened in this country. And Biscayne Bay is another ecologically sensitive area. And basically, they want to build those two. They're sort of dragging their feet. They're focusing a lot more right now on upgrading their existing reactors. So they've increased the output at St. Lucie. They're increasing the output of the two existing Turkey Point reactors. And they haven't really put a whole lot of money towards the new reactors yet. But there are obviously a lot of concerns. And one of them, of course, which we've mentioned a little bit in regards to Levy, and that's the water issue. Nuclear reactors take a lot of water, and while they're going to be pulling most of the cooling water from, Well, there's a couple of different ways they are, have proposed to do it. One is by treated wastewater, and it remains to be seen whether or not they'll actually be able to do that, because some of the laws that were making it seem like there would be an excess of treated wastewater, you know, there were some laws about going on about municipalities and treating wastewater and preventing some more wastewater from going into the ocean. Some of the laws that were instituted there have gotten like delays because municipalities didn't have the money to do what they had to do to make that happen. So it may not be that the wastewater they thought was going to be there is going to be available. So one of their other plans is to put these big giant radial wells in Biscayne Bay to just suck up, you know, 100 million gallons of water a day, essentially, is how much it usually takes to operate two reactors, at least 70 million, 80 million for the two reactors. So one of the things that stands out to me about the Turkey Point situation in regards to water is in the environmental impact statement, and I read this thing a couple of years ago, and Florida Power and Light has a chart in there that looks at the projected water increase from that point until, I think it was 2025, it may have been 2035, so I'm not sure about the time frame, but I know the numbers for sure. And they said that for residential and commercial use, they were expecting a 35% increase for residential and commercial. That's for all of the Miami-Dade area. 35% for all the people and all the business. And then for thermoelectric power generation, they said 3,224% increase. Wow, that's a lot. That is an unbelievable amount that they're expecting, an increase for thermoelectric power generation. And as it stands right now, the only new plants that are proposed in the Miami-Dade area are Turkey Point. So you're telling me that, you know, it's like a 100-fold increase over what the people are going to need to do their business and live. So I don't know that that's necessarily the best designation of resources long-term, especially in light of some of the very great work that's come out of Miami-Dade in regards to looking at longer-term sustainability. They did a great job addressing some of the water concerns in that report, and it doesn't seem like they at all looked at some of the existing proposals to see how the track they're on may be divergent from the track that they say they want to be on with their sustainability work.
My sister logged out, but she did add a few things in regards to the utilities and Duke Energy. She says, since Duke Energy bought Progress, we are about to become deregulated. She said, but not we're not deregulated yet. And then she said, she added, because they are not allowed to profit. So I'm not sure what she meant by that either. So that's kind of curious. I'll have to ask her and actually post that on the blog and have you answer it later, because I wanted her to be more specific, and she kind of logged out before she could give us the meat of that.
We'll circle back, and if it's not something I have the answer to, I can get the answer for it if I don't have it. So just definitely let me know, and we'll get that up there for your listeners.
But I wanted to cover just a few other things. We've kind of gone around the state in regards to Florida and covered Florida. What were some of the dangers of nuclear energy and some of the power plants that were affected by Hurricane Sandy, because I know when that was occurring, when the storm was on its way, there were some really, really big concerns about the aftermath in regards to the power plants up in that part of the United States.
Sandy definitely had some impact. Last summer, the floods in Iowa had serious impact on Fort Calhoun, which is still not operating again after those floods. The earthquake
Remember
in Virginia
that, yeah.
had some serious impact. So what we've seen is a series of increasingly serious events that have been going on. Floods, tornadoes. There were a series of tornadoes last year that knocked out power to reactors or knocked them offline, made them go into auto shutdown. And the thing I think to take into consideration. It doesn't matter what the storm is or where it is. If there's a nuclear reactor in the path of it and you're expecting flooding or down electric lines, these are all problems that could have serious safety implications at a nuclear reactor. Nuclear power is the only energy source that requires a backup energy to maintain safety. So they have to have an off-site power generating source to make sure that it stays safe. And, of course, on-site they rely on diesel generators and all of this kind of stuff. But right now we're in the midst of sort of learning what we can from what happened at Fukushima. And so the regulatory bodies are going through the process now to determine what we can do in the United States to make sure that something like that doesn't happen. But what they found out when they were doing their initial assessment is that a lot of the regulations are sort of like voluntary initiatives, and so the operators sort of get some choice as to how they respond to certain things. And so what they found is that the ability for reactors to cope with what they call a prolonged station blackout, it varies from site to site. Some sites it's 3 hours, some sites it's 8 hours, and so they're wanting to bring it up to a standard for all of the sites so that they can make sure that these things can stay safe if something like that happens where the off-site power is taken down. But the main thing I think to take away is that what happened in Japan at Fukushima definitely should be a wake-up call to the United States. The big thing that is a takeaway for me is that it just showed that human error is a factor that you can't exclude from the equation, no matter how good the science is. And the science wasn't good for Fukushima. There's a lot of stuff that's come to light that has shown that they knew that this could happen. And the same sort of thing happens here, at the North Anna reactor in Virginia. We had that big earthquake that happened, the East Coast earthquake, sort of surprised a lot of people. We didn't expect it wasn't a serious earthquake, but it was a higher magnitude than is generally predicted for that area. So we see this increase in seismic activity going on all over the place. How can we really plan for these things long term when you're looking at not only the 60 years, the 40 years of the initial license, the 20 years of the relicense, and then the hundreds and hundreds of years that the waste will be around after the reactors are no longer operating? How is it that we can plan so far ahead to know that there's always going to be power there to keep the cooling water circulating around so that a criticality doesn't occur? That's putting a lot of faith into a future that has too many question marks, It's a little disconcerting, to say the least.
My biggest fear, I think, after going to the teach-in where I first met you, was the gentleman that got up to speak about the cooling pools at Crystal River and how short they were, and if there had been a storm surge, the water definitely would have gone over the containment walls into the the rod cooling pools. And that concerned me greatly because I thought that could happen so easily after a hurricane, during a hurricane, just with a normal amount of storm surge. And it seems like the Big Bend of Florida is pretty much always under the firing line if we have any kind of storm in the Gulf region. So what's your take on that? How easy could that happen? Is it a likelihood?
I don't know as much about storm surge and how that, obviously that could knock out the power, and that's always a problem because you have to have power at a nuclear reactor to keep it safe. But I can say that our waste problem hasn't gotten any better, and most of the pools that are at operating reactors are packed way beyond the initial design basis. And the reason is because they never found a solution for the waste. And as I alluded to before, the NRC recently overturned its own decision. They had like this what they called the waste confidence rule. They basically said, oh, we'll figure it out. And they never figured it out, and so now they're having to go back to the drawing board, and they've got 2 years to come up with a new rule regarding waste before they're going to be able to do any licensing activities. And so there will be no new licenses and no license extensions while they're looking at that. But it's definitely a concern that we should all be paying a lot more attention to, because these reactors have been operating, some of them, for 20, 30 years already. They're getting close to the end of their 40 years, and the fuel pools are full in a lot of cases. They're just packing these spent fuel rods in tighter and tighter because they don't have anywhere else to put them. It's worrisome.
We're going into 6 minutes left on the show, or on your interview, because I do want to play Dr. Helen Caldicott for the second hour, half hour. I'm looking for a particular video of hers that was really quite brilliant, and it was the latest update that she did. But give us a little rundown on what we need to do as citizens in regard to being aware and activism, and who we need to be contacting, and just what we need to be doing to move forward to let our leaders know that this is, none of this is acceptable. It's just not.
I agree, and we have often have opportunities for direct action, for writing letters. We have different campaigns going on at different times depending upon what's happening at the legislature or at the Public Service Commission. So people can check our website, which is www.cleanenergy.org. We also have some community members are working on a website that's called Stop Nuclear Tax. It's www.stopnucleartax.com, and they have some different action opportunities available there sometimes. Right now, I think that the best thing that folks can do is contact their legislators. There's a lot of new people in office. There are people that were just reelected, and so it's time to start holding those leaders accountable to the things that matter to us. And I think that our energy future is definitely worth giving them a call about and letting them know this stop nuclear tax deal is a bad deal for the customers, and that we really need to work to get a renewable portfolio standard in our state so we can start looking for real solutions on energy for Florida's future.
How can people get in touch with you and SACE, and how can they get a message through to you? And they can just go to the SACE website and sign up for a newsletter.
The cleanenergy.org website has a place you can sign up for a newsletter, and we also have a listserv that is specifically for Florida-related stuff that I moderate. And if folks want to get in touch with me to join that list, or if they have questions on how they can get involved in what's happening in Florida, they can feel free to shoot me an email. It's my name, Mandy, M-A-N-D-Y, at cleanenergy.org.
Okay, and is there any parting words that you have for us in regards to solar energy and making our leaders focus, or trying to get our leaders to focus on that?
Well, we don't have much of a choice. Our time is running out, and I think that we just sound silly calling ourselves the Sunshine State with so little solar on our roofs. And if Germany can meet a lot of its power through distributed rooftop solar, I think that Florida has a lot of work it can do, because Florida is a lot sunnier than Germany is. And I think that our leaders should make sure that they're not picking winners and losers when it comes to our energy future. The way it stands right now, nuclear is it's getting all the chips. It's getting all the attention because of this unfair legislation. And if the playing field were leveled, I think that renewables and efficiency would take us a lot further in a lot cleaner, safer way than all of this nuclear mess.
Well, Mandy, I want to thank you very much for being on the show and filling us in on all this valuable information. And really, when we look at our leaders, we know they're not working for us any longer. And I really do believe, I'm sincere in this, that change has to come from the bottom and go to the top, because we already know it's not going to come from the top and come back down to us.
So that's why we do what we do.
Yeah, it's really up to we the people. So I would encourage everybody to get in touch with Mandy, go to cleanenergy.org. Sign up for the newsletter, get involved, and if you can't go out and actually hold a sign, You can be an armchair warrior. You can write letters to the editor. You can get on call-in programs. There's lots and lots of things you can do just from sitting right at your computer. So I encourage everybody to do that. Write your legislators. Don't stop. Don't give up. But, Mandy, thank you so much. And we will definitely love to have you on again at some point, especially if we need a real concise update on what's happening with the nuclear reactors here in Florida.
So, just let me know. I'd be happy to. Thanks for having me, Anita. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Mandy. You have a good
night. All right. You too. Thanks. Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye. And that was Mandy, and she is from SACE, which is the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. She is the high-risk energy organizer, Mandy Hancock. So really, really great and valuable information. I'm going to spend our last hour replaying an audio from Dr. Helen Caldicott. This was recorded on April 2nd in 2012, and it is titled Evacuating, What We Learned from Fukushima. Stand by, and this will be started in just 1 minute. Bear with me. And I know you're going to enjoy this. If you have any other questions or concerns, please leave them on our blog post at wisewomenmedia.podcast.com. There's links there. And there's a way for you to leave a message to me. If you have any suggestions for guests, just email me at Anita Stewart, that's A-N-I-T-A-S-T-E-W-A-R-T, at gmail.com. 1 moment, and this audio feed will begin.
And when I first came in 78, most Americans I spoke to said to me, it's better to be dead than red. Now, I remember when I first came to America in 1965, I went through immigration. They said to me, are you a communist? I didn't even really know what a communist was, you know. And then so this was this sort of ethic. And I said, what, you'd rather be blown up in every war? Yeah. I said, well, what about the pygmies in Africa? They'll die too. And people said, yeah, well, they don't want to be communists either. So I thought, this is sort of psychotic. So then I mobilized with others. 23,000 doctors, and we started describing the medical effects of nuclear war, doing a wonderful symposium in LA organized by the Saxons, and another wonderful one in Seattle organized by Judy Lipton, and people were actually scalping tickets at the door. It was so popular. And after, you know, a few years of this, and I was on television because I had a great agent in Hollywood who represented me and put me on with film stars. No one wanted to hear a boring old doctor talking about nuclear war, but they wanted to see Sally Field and Lily Tomlin. And, you know, after a while, people started to say, well, nuclear war is bad for our health. And then I was even asked to address the annual Morticians Association. And I said, well, what do you want me to talk to you about? They said, well, we don't want to have to embalm radioactive bodies. And I said, don't worry, you'll be one yourself. So it got to be really rather ridiculous. But in 5 years, we, the medical profession, because of our extraordinary credibility, so I always said every politician has a doctor. 80% of Americans were opposed to nuclear war. 80%. Now, that's the second American Revolution. It was peaceful, sagacious, and Gandhian, and all done through education. And that led, and I met with Reagan in the White House and held his hand for about an hour and a quarter, reassuring him because he didn't know anything. I think he was a bit brighter than W. I also diagnosed he had impending Alzheimer's, which he did. But apart from that, I think I did actually influence him because he started to say thereafter, nuclear war must never be fought and can never be won. And he started working with Gorbachev. And we, the physicians, led the movement to end the Cold War. And we need to credit ourselves with that. That was very, very significant. But after that, we got in George I, who was quite good. He unilaterally removed a few tactical nuclear weapons in Europe to help Gorbachev in what he was doing in Russia. But then we got Clinton. And I really resent Bill Clinton, William Jefferson Clinton, because we handed to him on a silver platter the ability to abolish nuclear weapons. And there had been a precedent, because Reagan and Gorbachev met in Reykjavik over a weekend and almost agreed to abolish nuclear weapons. I mean, it was the most extraordinary situation. And it failed because Reagan was attached to Star Wars. You know, there was this yellow plastic shield over America and the weapons would come in and go boink, boink, boink and bounce off. It would never work. It was Teller's idea and Teller was mad. Gorbachev knew it would never work, but both men were obstinate. And they came out having almost agreed to abolish nuclear weapons, and they failed. So there's a precedent. And Clinton could have drawn up a document to abolish nuclear weapons in 5 years, and you must know that of the 23,000 H-bombs in the world today, Russia and America own 97%. People go on and on about Iran, which does not have nuclear weapons, and all the intelligence agencies in America say there's no evidence they have any or intend to build any. And so that's called displacement activity. If you put rats in a cage and threaten them with a lethal situation, they run away and do something irrelevant to that which threatens them. The real rogue nations and the axis of evil are Russia and America, holding the world at nuclear ransom, ready to blow the world up tonight. And we get very close to within seconds of them pressing a button because a computer makes a mistake or the satellites are set off by a flock of geese or a rising moon thinking America's under attack, or they mistake a weather satellite going up in Norway for an attack on Moscow, and Yeltsin got to within 10 seconds of pressing the button in 1995. I don't know how we're still here. And the Chinese are hacking into the early warning system as we speak. And so are young kids, because it's all computerized, for God's sake. And I'll talk about where you sit here today in terms of nuclear weapons, but it's what Kennedy said. Our life hangs on a silken thread, the twisting sword of Damocles over our heads every second of every day. And by God, we ignore it. Therefore, we're mentally sick. And when people are suicidal, we hospitalize them because they're sick. They need help. The whole society's sick. They're arguing about, I shouldn't really get into this, but women's vaginas and, you know. For God's sake, what the hell are they on about, these stupid men? Stupid men. I mean, I shouldn't be talking about this, but, you know. It's all. What I'm really talking about is etiology. Hands up, the physicians in this audience. Yeah, etiology is the cause of a disease, and if you don't diagnose the cause, you can't cure the disease. We can't cure cancer. We can cure polio now because we isolated the polio virus, Sabine Enders and Jonas Salk. But the cause of the nuclear pathology infecting the planet is the macros, and we are the macros. But it's our brains, and it's not our neocortexes, it's our reptilian midbrain. And there are some reptilian midbrains that have a toxic reaction to testosterone. And you can name those reptilian midbrains in the head of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and other such characters. The other interesting point, I think, is that 1 in 25 people are sociopaths. Sociopaths are brilliant, charming, erudite, sexy, rise to the top like cream in any organization. There were quite a few of them at Harvard, where I worked, medical school. You can see them in corporations, Goldman Sachs. You can see them in government. But they have no moral conscience, none, and they lie with impunity. And they're the ones that rise to the top like cream and run the show. So, and we're reluctant to get into etiology, but the etiology is psychiatric. And unless we are prepared to diagnose the etiology and talk about it, nothing is going to happen. I do think we're an evolutionary aberrant, and I'm not sure how much longer we're going to survive, and we'll take maybe 30 million species with us, but we do have an opportunity because of our innate intelligence. And we use, of course, our neocortex to rationalise what our midbrain wants us to do, don't we? We can rationalise anything. And the other fascinating thing is that in male midbrains, the instincts for violence and sex are very intertwined. And each of those dynamics produces dopamine. And dopamine's like really nice stuff. You know, it's what you get released when you have an orgasm. It's really nice. And apparently violence induces that too, and they're intimately related. And it's very interesting to me, the relationship, I'm totally off track. I'll get on track in a minute. The relationship in the military between sex and violence. Why do they play porno films to blokes who are taking off from aircraft carriers to go and kill people, for instance? Why do men rape women when they conquer a territory and the women have had nothing to do with anything? And so I want to explore this in a book I want to write called Why Men Kill and Why Women Let Them. And the women are really pathetic, I think. We're pathetic. Anyway, so it's time we grew up and became strong. Anyway, apart from that, I'm going to tell you about Fukushima and nuclear power. Sorry I got diverted, but that's kind of where my brain is at the moment. Okay, so I'm not going to walk you through the whole nuclear fuel chain, uranium mining, but suffice it to say that in Australia, we have 40% of the world's richest uranium. We're selling it to friend and foe alike, as if there's no tomorrow, and there probably won't be any tomorrow. We're selling it to India that hasn't signed the NPT. We're selling it to probably in Pakistan that hasn't signed the NPT. Or did it? I don't know. We're selling it, we want to sell it to Saudi Arabia, and you know, anyone who wants it, really. And anyone that gets uranium can make themselves a bomb. I'll go through that in a minute. It is said that nuclear power produces no global warming, which is an absolute straight-out lie. And I must say that I don't believe in freedom of speech. I don't believe that people like Rush Limbaugh should have the opportunity to lie to a mass of ignorant people about science. If we lie in medicine, we would be killing or damaging our patients, and we would be deregistered, like the man who said that immunization causes autism. He's been deregistered. So it's totally inappropriate to lie about science when the Earth is in the intensive care unit, critically and possibly terminally ill. And so it's totally inappropriate for people like Rush Limbaugh, who doesn't know, well, there's a very rude Australian expression which I won't use, doesn't know anything. And people, millions of people listen to him. This is totally inappropriate. And then Murdoch, you know, well, I won't go into Murdoch. He actually created my career in Australia. Now, so the first chapter of this book deals with the fact that nuclear power produces massive quantities of global warming because the nuclear power plant does not stand alone. It is underlaid by a massive industrial infrastructure. You have to mine millions of tons of uranium, fossil fuel. You just watch those trucks. They're as big as this church truck. And then you've got to mill it, crush it into little fine particles, that more fossil fuel. And then the uranium is enriched in America and at Paducah. They use two 1,500 megawatt coal-fired plants to enrich the uranium. Oh, but it doesn't produce any CO2, right? Well, people should be sued. I mean, there must be a law that people can't lie. This is so important, and it's a medical problem. And we sit back, you know, waiting in our consulting rooms for the patients to present with their lumps, their indigestion, or their hematemesis, or their hemoptysis, or the pneumothorax, and it's too late. We don't get out and say, okay, I want to educate you about medicine. I mean, there are lots of things we could do, like why you shouldn't hand your antibiotics over the fence to Mrs. Brown, because a year ago you had the same symptoms as Mrs. Brown, and why don't you have the rest of my antibiotics? I mean, people don't know anything about viruses and bacteria, and that's because we haven't taught them. But we must teach them about this too. The other thing is that at the enrichment plant at Paducah, Kentucky, uranium is converted to a gas called uranium hexafluoride, which is very corrosive and very hot. And there are hundreds of miles of pipes containing this gas that is filtered through a cascade of filters. On one side stays uranium-235, which is the one that is the fissionable one, and the other side, actually, it's reverse. Say U-238, which is non-fissionable, and this is 235. 235 is present in 0.7% in natural uranium. It must be enriched to 3% for use in reactors, over 50%, and you've got bomb-grade material, and the bomb dropped on Hiroshima was a uranium bomb. But because there are hundreds of miles of these pipes that are very hot, beside them are other pipes containing CFC gas. Now, you know that the Montreal Protocol bans CFC gas because it destroys the ozone. And in Australia, 1 in 9 people now get malignant melanoma because the sun is so intensely toxic. And, you know, old people are just absolutely covered in SCCs and VCCs. I mean, you sit in a dermatology clinic, it's unbelievable. That's from the sun. And we are very racist in Australia. The Aborigines have the highest infant mortality in the world, dreadful conditions, we stole their land, but we like to lie in the sun and turn brown in the summer and you know, get a lot of melanin in our skins like the Aborigines. Anyway, so this CFC, it circulates through hundreds of miles of pipes, and 93% of the CFC-114 gas, which is a commonest here, is released in America from the uranium enrichment plant, and it's 10 to 20,000 times more potent as a global warmer than CO2. Fancy that. How did I find that out? Well, I called the EPA, and I found this really nice woman called Nancy something, and she sent me all the data. And there are many other actual global warming gases used in the production of uranium for nuclear power. So I can't tell you the sense of indignation I have that people are lying about this, particularly the nuclear industry, saying they're the answer to global warming. And I would like all of you to take this into your hearts and souls too, and your bones, and get out there and teach your friends, and if they don't listen, hit them on the head. Okay. So that's uranium. Anyway, you enrich the uranium to 3%. I won't go into the whole details, but it's all in this book. Also, I guess I need to mention that nuclear power is exorbitantly expensive. It costs now $10 to $13 billion to build a nuclear reactor. And you know who pays for that? You do. I do too, because I pay tax here too, which I really resent. Most of it goes to the Pentagon. So you totally pay for the construction, the enrichment, the insurance, everything. You can't insure your house against nuclear power accidents, you can't insure yourself, nothing. But it all comes from your tax dollars. And then the utilities grab the reactor once it's built and pump out the electricity like there's no tomorrow, and they make huge profits. That's why they don't want to close the reactors down, because it's too expensive to build more. Now, the cost of decommissioning or taking apart an old radioactive reactor is beyond compare, much more expensive than building it, and no one's ever done it. And you have to wait till they cool down because they're so terribly radioactively hot. And they have to be taken apart by robots and remote control. It's interesting at Fukushima, Japan is the leading producer of robots, yet they had never made robots to withstand very high radiation areas because they always assumed that they wouldn't have an accident. So they had no robots to deal with what they're dealing with now. Isn't it interesting, the psychic numbing that people practice? And we all practice psychic numbing, except children. Children don't. But numbing, why is that? I mean, kids are so honest and alert, and it's only when their hormones, those nasty things, start circulating at menarche, that the kids go, they lose it. And they are able then psychologically to block out unpleasant realities. And my grandson, Paulie, is going through this at the moment. He was a gorgeous kid who looked like a face on the Sistine Chapel, and suddenly he's getting all hairy, and, you know, he'd say, how are you, Paulie? He won't even talk to me anymore. And as my daughter said to him and his sort of hairy friends that trudge through the house, she says, well, we can't really trust you because your frontal lobes haven't developed yet. They haven't. Okay, so cost. I mean, I say no more, it's just ridiculous, the cost of nuclear power. Why do people want nuclear power? Well, again, it's a midbrain attitude. You know, when they split the atom, it was very exciting. And in my other book, Nuclear Power, The New Nuclear Danger, there's a fascinating study by an anthropologist called Hugh Gustafson, who went to live with the weapons makers in Los Alamos for a year, and he used to drink pub at night and go to church with them, and actually many of them are his dear friends. And their psychology is absolutely amazing. When a man designs a new nuclear weapon that's to be tested in the desert in Nevada, he, that night, goes out and sleeps with the weapon alone in the desert before it's exploded the next day. And he talks about having labor pains. I kid you not. And the need to push. When the weapon explodes, he then talks about postnatal depression. Yeah, isn't that fascinating? So, the emergence of new life, the creation of new life is compared to annihilation in these men's minds. And they talk about people being killed, that's collateral damage. We're inanimate objects, whereas the weapons, they grow whiskers as they get old. They have arms and legs. There's a triad, and they're arms, nuclear arms. And they have all sorts of human characteristics. And it's very important that we as physicians look at the psychology behind what drives these men. Similarly, with nuclear power, the Department of Energy calls solar power and wind power soft energy, like as my father would have said, you know, his name's Cedric and he's got lace on his underpants sort of thing. Dad hadn't grown up at a time when there were gay people. But nuclear power is hard energy. Okay? So there's a fascination with this, combined with the fact that I wrote an article for the New York Times on December 2nd where there was a psychologist in the Department of Defense, I can't remember his name, in 52, who said we need nuclear power, virtue is a camouflage for the weapons industry because it's one and the same technology. So kid yourselves not, it's all part of blowing up the planet, which is ultimate power and ultimate instinct for annihilation. Isn't that fascinating? We have to start examining this and getting into the etiology. Okay, now I want to walk you through Fukushima and what's been happening and also Chernobyl and what sort of medical implications would be involved with what's going on at Fukushima. So you build a reactor, which looks like this, and you pack 100 tons of uranium into the reactor, enriched to 3% of 235. Uranium formed into little ceramic pellets packed in zirconium fuel rods 12 feet long and half an inch thick, like a curtain rod. We call them drapes, but we call them curtains. Okay, so 100 tons. And then between these fuel rods are boron moderating rods, which moderate the flux of neutrons. The whole thing's immersed in water, and you gradually pull out the moderating rods. And then the whole mass of uranium, 100 tons, reaches critical mass. And the atoms start breaking apart spontaneously as the uranium atom shoots out a neutron. Neutron shoots into another uranium atom, which shoots up two more, and then on and on. And as the uranium atoms are hit by the neutrons, they fracture into various particles. And 200 new radioactive elements are formed, none of which existed before man fissioned the atom. They're all highly toxic, much more so than uranium, which is pretty toxic itself. And so as they pull the moderating rods out, you therefore, as the atom split, release E equals MC squared. Energy equals the mass of the atom times the speed of the light squared, the most enormous sort of energy that Einstein developed when he watched, suddenly discovered when he watched a tram go by and he realized E equals MC squared. What a brain. I think he was operating from his neocortex. Anyway, so as that energy is released, there's tremendous heat. And the heat boils the water. And then the water turns to steam. Steam's taken off, which turns the generator, which generates electricity. So all a nuclear power plant is designed to do is to boil water. That's all it's designed to do. It's like cutting a pound of butter with a chainsaw. Right? Get it? But what is actually made, and how much radiation then is developed in this reactor? The equivalent of 1,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs. That's what is in these reactors. But then, every year they have to remove 30 tons of the fuel rods because they're so full of these elements that are so stinking hot radiologically and thermally that they're inefficient for the reaction. And usually the fuel pools, spent fuel pools, which they euphemistically call swimming pools, are on the roof of the reactors. And they're packed on racks. But because the nuclear industry thought that by this time there would be a place to put their spent fuel, they didn't build enough spent fuel pools. So they're re-racking the rods closer and closer together, and there could be a meltdown in the spent fuel pools, and there were in Japan. At Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant, at the entrance of Cape Cod, where the Kennedys live, there's more cesium-137 in the spent fuel pool than that released by all the atmospheric atomic explosions conducted by Russia, China, United States, France, and England. More cesium in one spent fuel pool. And if that melts down, well, you can imagine where that would go. Much worse than Fukushima. Now, as a reactor operates, it routinely emits radioactive elements because it can't operate without doing it. And, you know, they use these euphemisms. Oh, it's just routine releases. Don't worry about it. You know, I'm just routinely radiating you. So, you know, you might get cancellated, but it's just routine. Don't worry about it. Okay? So let me talk about what they routinely release every day. Xenon, argon and krypton. Now, these are called noble gases. They're gamma emitters, and I didn't walk you through the radiation. You all understand X-rays. We're the biggest irradiators of the public. CT scans give you a whopping dose. Never have a CT scan unless absolutely indicated. Each dose of radiation is dangerous. There is no radiation that is safe, and it's cumulative. So each dose you receive adds to your risk of getting cancer. Do not walk through those X-ray machines at the airport. I don't care if they stick their fingers in all my orifices. I'm not going to go through those machines. And they are sending fetuses through them. Fetuses are thousands of times more radiosensitive than adults. One X-ray to the pregnant abdomen doubles the incidence of leukemia in that baby. That's Alice Stewart's work, an English woman who was roundly criticized by the nuclear industry until they found out that she was actually correct. She was once testifying before a Senate committee here. She was great English. And one senator was giving her a bad time, and she turned him and said, "Now listen to me, young man." That shut him up. Anyway, there are X-rays, and they just pass straight through you, but at the instant they pass through you, you can be damaged and a mutation can occur in a gene, right? Gamma radiation is like X-rays. Non-particulate goes straight through you. Alpha radiation, two protons and two neutrons emitted from an unstable atom. Very, very mutagenic. Alpha particles don't pass through the skin, the layers of dead layers of epidermis to damage living cells, but when in contact with living cells in the lung, gut, liver, you name it, very carcinogenic. Uranium is an alpha emitter. Beta is an electron emitted from an unstable. They all do the same thing. So for those who aren't physicians, in every cell is a nucleus, there are chromosomes, and there is a gene or pair of genes called the regulatory gene that controls the rate of cell division. If hit by some radiation, and I'm missing it each time I got it, then the DNA molecule, if a cell doesn't die, is mutated or biochemically altered. So and the cell will sit dormant for any time from 5 to 70 years, which is the incubation time for cancer. And one day, instead of the cell dividing into two by mitosis, it goes crazy and produces trillions of cells. That's a cancer. And the cells are very invasive, and they'll get into a lymph vessel or a blood vessel, and one cell will go up to the brain and grow into a second cancer. That's called metastasizing. And the body eventually becomes full of cancers, and a cancer is a parasite, and it grows and proliferates, and then as the body just withers away and dies, when the body dies, the cancer dies. So it takes a single alpha particle, there's a single gene, in a single cell to kill you. Get it? Now, there are other genes that are more important than normal cells, somatic cells in the body, and they're called the germ cells, the sperm and the eggs. And the sperm and eggs carry all the genes for future generations, and all those genes are vulnerable to being damaged by radiation. We all carry several hundred genes for disease. Why? Because it's radiation over time that induced evolution. Radiation caused the fish to develop lungs and the birds to develop wings. And for us to evolve into this incredible creature with an opposing thumb and this huge neocortex. But most mutations are deleterious. They cause disease. Very few are advantageous to survive in a difficult environment. But they occur over billions of years. And what we're doing by increasing the level of background radiation in our food and our air through nuclear power and Hanford and the like is increasing the number of deleterious mutations. Now, interestingly, I've been saying this for years, we all carry several hundred genes for disease like diabetes and cystic fibrosis, my specialty. There are 2,600 genetic diseases. You all must listen to this. It's very important. But the other day, my son was diagnosed with hemochromatosis. Hemochromatosis is a disease which is an abnormality in iron metabolism, and you collect iron in your tissues, and you can get cardiomyopathy. It destroys the heart muscle. You can get cirrhosis of the liver. I, therefore, carry the recessive gene for hemochromatosis because it knocked me over with a feather, and so does my ex-husband. Isn't that fascinating? Called a Mendelian recessive. And normally Mendelian recessives take about 20 generations for the two of them to get together to express the disease like diabetes or cystic fibrosis or hemochromatosis. There are the dominant ones like the dwarf, achondroplastic dwarfs, you see, who have normal trunks and very short arms and legs and big heads. That's a dominant. And at Children's Hospital in Boston, I once saw a family. Mother was normal, father was an achondroplast. They had five children following in their wake, four of whom were achondroplastic dwarfs. So it's a toss of the coin each time, Russian roulette. Okay, so as we fill up the environment with radiation, so we're going to increase, we're damaging the very building blocks of life, and most people don't understand that. And they are passed on generation to generation to generation. That's the thing. Once you do produce a mutation, if you reproduce, it will probably be, two of my children are carriers. My daughter won't get herself tested, and she's a doctor. She's a bit difficult. As daughters are wont to be. Now, so I didn't finish the xenon, krypton, and argon. These are xenon, krypton, and argon. They're called noble gases. They're gas because they don't combine biochemically in the body. However, if you inhale them into your lung, they are absorbed through the alveoli and they're very fat soluble. And where are the main fatty tissues of the body? The abdominal fat pad and the upper thighs. And what is located in that area? The gonads, the testicles and ovaries. And they're very high energy gamma emitters like X-rays. So people who live near nuclear reactors, if there's an inversion system, and these things are emitted all the time, they could be enveloped in a cloud of xenon or krypton or argon, inhale it and damage their genes. Okay? And also their regulatory genes later to cause cancer. What you also should know is children are 10 to 20 times more radiosensitive than adults, but little girls are twice as sensitive than little boys. Getting cancer, and that we haven't talked about that much, but we don't know why. We don't know why. Now, what else comes out routinely? Tritium. Tritium is H3 instead of H2. And it's used in exit signs. It's used on watch dial. It's used on airport signs for the planes to see. It is a tiny, very active molecule. It gets out of every single container except gold, because gold is so dense. It'll escape from stainless steel, glass, plastic, you name it. So you can't contain tritium. And the nuclear industry says, it's only radioactive hydrogen. Well, it combines with oxygen to form tritiated water. And, you know, there are often fogs around nuclear power plants and full of tritiated water. And this tritium actually can get right through the skin. Now, the skin lets nothing through because it's the most important organ of the body. That's why when you get a burn, you get so sick because you lose the protective mechanism. It also is inhaled into the lung and also bioconcentrates in the food chain and you can't taste it. And it's nasty stuff because it combines in the DNA molecule. It's highly mutagenic. It's a soft beta emitter. And I write all about it in this book. And there's a huge literature written by the nuclear power industry because they're scared of tritium, but they say, look, well, it's really okay. It's only tritium. It causes brain tumours, muscular tumours. Well, it causes cancers in many organs. Okay, that's tritium. Carbon-14 routinely released, and its half-life is long. I can't remember, thousands of years. The half-life of this one is 12.2 years. That means if you start with a pound of tritium in 12.2 years, you have half a pound. In another 12.2 years, you have a quarter of a pound. It decays exponentially. Do you see? Multiply that by 10 or 20 to get its total radiological life. Each reactor releases 1 million picocuries of tritium a day. A million picocuries of tritium a day from its cooling pools and from the reactor. Now, that's very interesting because Germany, and you know how studious and didactic the Germans are, studied children under the age of 5 who live within 5 kilometres of the reactor. 5 kilometres, what is it, 2.5 miles? It's 16 old reactors, and they found that the children under the age of have double the incidence of leukemia and a high incidence of cancer. That's because of the tritium. And that's also because of the argon, xenon, krypton, and carbon-14, and other releases they sometimes, you know, just routinely release. The study was reproduced in France, and they found the same thing. Now, it's never been done here. Why? Because if you do it, then you've got to do something about it, like maybe close the reactors down, and the parents are going to rise up and get really upset. So if you don't want to do anything, don't do the study. Your industry is really evil. And I use that word advisedly and carefully, not just off the top of my head, because killing people is evil. Can you say? Thou shalt not kill? Okay, so now I want to go on to the other elements. I can't go through all of them, but I will give you an example of some that got out of Fukushima, and then I'll go on to Chernobyl. I-131, what's the, you all know, where does iodine go in the body? Where? Thyroid, yeah. And in, particularly in little children, they suck it up like a sponge. It's a beta, that electron, and a high-energy gamma. It's got a half-life of 8 days, so it's around for about 10 weeks. When it lands on the soil, the grass sucks it up and bioconcentrates it by orders of magnitude. The cattle then eat the grass. I can't draw a cow, but the active organ is this one. And it concentrates most highly in the milk, and then a pregnant woman may be drinking the milk. So as the radioactive iodine passes through the breast tissue, it can mutate a cell to cause cancer later, huh? And then the baby, that gorgeous little tiny baby, so sensitive to radiation, drinks the radioactive breast milk. And so what happens is that there's biomagnification of all these isotopes up the food chain. And the scary thing is you can't taste, smell, or see radiation in your food, or in the fish you might be catching here that are swimming over from Fukushima, where they tip more radiation into the sea than anyone's ever, ever seen before. Beware. I'll talk about that in a minute. Now, what they do, you also need to know, is that there is a town in Japan called Itate, which got a high amount of fallout. They looked at over 3,000 children in Itate, little ones, and 30% have thyroid nodules. Now, that's really early. It's within a year. You don't expect solid cancers to start appearing for 15 years. And leukemia for 5 years. This is within a year. And you know what the Japanese government is doing? They're following them. Okay, hands up those who know that that's a stupid thing to do. Follow them. Yes. Well, what you have to do is you have to either remove the nodule or do a fine needle biopsy to see what the histology is. And if indeed it's malignant, then you do a total thyroidectomy. And then the child still might die from metastases from the thyroid tumour, And the child then has to have thyroid replacement, thyroxine, for the rest of their life, like a diabetic with insulin, or they'll die. So to follow children with thyroid nodules, and children are so sensitive, cancer spread really fast in children because their cells are so actively dividing, is wicked. And that's classical of what the Japanese government is doing. It's not testing the food routinely. Children are living in very, very high radiation areas, and they're just passing Geiger counters over the children's thyroids to pick up the gamma, but that doesn't pick up the beta. And the only way to find out what is in the children's bodies is to put them into a whole body counter, which measures the spectrum of gamma radiation given off by all the isotopes. And then you can say, oh, I've got cesium-137, cesium-134, radioactive iodine, there's some plutonium. The only way, and they've got hardly any whole body counters in Japan. So they're not looking at the people adequately, particularly the children. Cesium-137 is a really nasty one. Its half-life is 30 years. It's around for 600 years. It's a beta and a gamma, and it's a potassium analog. So our cells are rich in potassium. It causes brain tumors, rhabdomyosarcomas. Hands up those who've ever seen a rhabdo. You have, yeah, very, very rare form of muscle sarcoma, particularly in children. Tumors of testicles and ovaries and the like. And the other one is cesium-134, which is even worse. Its half-life is 2 years. So the shorter the half-life, the more radioactive it is. And equal amounts of cesium-137 and 134 got out at Fukushima. Okay, this is obviously Europe. And here's the reactor at Chernobyl. And the dark patches are really areas that should be uninhabitable, but people are still living there. And you can see that it went all over Europe. And it's only cesium and 200 isotopes got out. Some last only seconds and they've decayed away to nothing. But there would be over 100 isotopes, all of which have different pathways in the body, different metabolic pathways. But this is only cesium. Turkey is not on the map, but Turkey got a whopping dose of radiation. Never buy Turkish food. In fact, from this map, you should never buy European food. Never buy cheese from the Scandinavian countries. They got a huge dose. There are over 300 farms in Cumbria and Wales now whose land is so full of cesium. The government told them to shut their farms down. And they said, for how long? And they said, 100 years. It's not, it's 600 years. 40% of the European land mass is currently radioactive. You don't know what food you're buying from Europe, whether it's olive oil from Spain, or Spain got a fair bit and they haven't mapped Spain, nor did they map France, because the French are so darn arrogant and 80% of their electricity comes from nuclear power. They said the radiation from Chernobyl stopped at the French border. But they're now finding a higher incidence of cancer that's developing now in France. In Australia we don't have radioactive food. We've got great clean food. We just export uranium so everyone else can have it. And I'm really careful. I rang the man in Melbourne, Australia, who tests the food from Europe, and I said, how do you test it? He said, oh, we do random spot checks. I said, well, how do you pick up the stuff to test? He said, oh, the computer picks it out. So obviously, a lot is missed. And I said, what do you do when you find radioactive food? Oh, he said, we dilute it with non-radioactive food. The solution to pollution by dilution is fallacious when it comes to radiation. You get it? I've already explained why, haven't I? Because of the food chain. And that applies to fish too. Then the strontium-90, which Linus Pauling, bless his soul, and Barry Comedy used to talk about. It's a calcium analog, half-life 28 days. It's around for 600 years all over Europe. And it causes bone cancer, osteogenic sarcoma, multiple myeloma, leukemia. And what's the cancer of the red blood cells where you get too many red blood cells? What is it? What? No. No, come on. Too many red blood cells. Come on. Got polycythemia zero. Yeah. Okay, this is a beta and a gamma. And last but least, I'll explain to you, but please remember this is only just a tiny portion representative of what escapes, plutonium. Now, Pluto is named after not the dog, but the god of hell. I first read about plutonium when I was a young medical student. And a bit older, I learned we had a lot of uranium. I've got a book out called Poison Power by Goffman and Tamplin. Goffman works for the AEC. And I read about plutonium. I nearly got alopecia totalis. As I was reading the book, like my hair fell out. I'd never read anything so dangerous. But let me walk you through it. It's an alpha emitter. Such that 10 to the 6 grams is definitely carcinogenic, and a million to the gram, but it's probably 10 to the minus 9 grams. When they injected it into beagle dogs, they didn't find a dose low enough that didn't give every dog cancer. Right? It is an alpha. It's got a half-life of 24,400 years, so it's around, you know, it's a quarter to half a million years. It's all over Europe. It's an iron analogue. It's not absorbed well from the gut, but in neonatal guts it's absorbed because they're immature, and in chlorinated water it's absorbed better. But it is inhaled into the lung, and, of course, it lands there, down here, and because the alpha particle travels only a very short distance, and as radiation decreases with the square of the distance, most cells die within that volume, but on the periphery, cells remain viable and get mutated. And that's why it's so carcinogenic. Now, macrophages pick it up and take it to the mediastinal lymph glands, which is called lymphoma, Hodgkin's, and the like. It is stored in the liver, of course, where iron is stored, where it can cause hepatocarcinoma. It goes to the bone, of course, where it can induce osteogenic sarcoma, polycythemia vera, multiple myeloma, and leukemia. It crosses the placenta. Now, the placenta lets very few things pass, but because it's an iron analog, it gets into the developing embryo, which, like thalidomide, it's going to kill a cell that's going to form the left half of the brain or the right arm. And if you look at this book produced by the New York Academy of Sciences on Chernobyl, where they translated 5,000 articles from Russian into English, there are homes full of the most grossly deformed children around Chernobyl that we have never seen before in the history of pediatrics. I'll pass it round for you to look at. This book also goes through all the deformities and deaths and premature aging and cataracts people get from radiation and heart disease and cancer. And already by now, over a million people have died from Chernobyl. And that's the first 25 years. This is a total cover-up. It's the biggest cover-up in the history of medicine that I've ever read about. Fukushima is 2.5 to 3 times worse. So you multiply a million in 25 years by 3, because we in medicine always look at the worst-case possibility and work to prevent that, right? These children, this is called teratogenesis. It's what thalidomide did, but there are homes full of children like this, and just pass it round, and you all must look at that. That's plutonium. The other thing is it's got a predilection for the testicles. And every male in the Northern Hemisphere has a tiny load of plutonium in his testicles from weapons testing days. And it tends to deposit just next to the spermatogonia in the testicle, irradiating the genes of the coming sperm. And so, therefore, the genetic mutations are passed on generation to generation. Meanwhile, if the man is cremated, his smoke goes up the chimney. Anyway, don't get cremated. It adds to global warming. Get buried. Feeds the soil. The plutonium goes up the chimney, so another man can inhale it and get into his testicle. And so you can see more than an exponential increase in genetic damage for the rest of time. And don't forget, we're not the only species with testicles. And we inhabit the planet with 30 million other species, all of which can be damaged by radiation in the environment. Now, I quickly will do Fukushima. Fukushima is a catastrophe beyond Chernobyl. There have been 3 meltdowns. They knew in the first 2 or 3 days that there were meltdowns, but they didn't tell the Japanese people for 3 months. Japan's a feudalistic society, and everyone, you know, can apologize, and the women are very, they're speaking little tiny voices, but the women are just starting to get really angry, and they're rising up. The amount of radiation that got out is all estimates, guesstimates. There are no measurements. There were no radiation monitors active at the time, except some called sieverts or whatever, the something system, which measures radiation from fallout from weapons testing. And they actually knew where the radiation was going, but they didn't tell the people because they didn't want to cause panic. So the people ran exactly right into the area where the radiation was falling in the northwest. The first few days, the winds were blowing towards the east and blew over the Pacific. And that was lucky, because if they'd blown over Japan, Tokyo would have had to be evacuated. As it is, about half of Japan is now contaminated. Half the rice grown in Japan is grown in Fukushima Prefecture, and it's coming in with cesium-137 in it. There's a cesium-137 in the tea grown south of Tokyo. There are very, very hot spots in Tokyo, and when you watch Arne Gunderson this afternoon, who I work very closely with, the nuclear engineer, he's just been in Tokyo, and he had his Geiger counter, and he just sort of put it down, and the thing went mad. So there are hot spots all over Tokyo, which is a long way from Fukushima. I mean, I can't tell you what sort of catastrophe this is. And also, there were hydrogen explosions in the four reactors. Oh, well, I can show you this. Here are the reactors looking really nice and hygienic and terrific and painted blue and white. And this is what they look like afterwards. See that building's absolutely shattered. Unit 3 didn't burst apart. Unit 4 did here. Well, that's a close-up. What a catastrophe. And where did the hydrogen come from? As they locked they lost their external power supply from the earthquake. Each reactor needs 1 million gallons a minute circulating to keep it cool of water. So when they lost their pumps, they've got diesel generators underneath the reactors, and then in came the tsunami and absolutely destroyed the diesel generators. So they couldn't cool the reactors, so they melted down within 24 to 48 hours. But as they melted, the zirconium on the cladding of the fuel rod reacted with the water to produce hydrogen, and hydrogen collected in the containment of the building. And when you get hydrogen, it's like the Hindenburg, it exploded and totally destroyed. Look at this. And unit 4, there was an explosion in the cooling pool. I think unit 2, the cooling pool, had an atomic excursion, in other words, an atomic explosion. And plutonium is being found miles and miles away from the reactor because it came from the spent fuel rods in the cooling pool that had an atomic excursion. Australian Radiation Service, so for the first 3 days, here it is, and then 6 days getting over to you. This is where you are here, and 10 days you're enveloped in a cloud of radioactive fallout. And it was very hot, very high. And again, you can see the 18th of March, it's just hitting you. 21st of March is still hitting you, but it's passed all the way over to Boston, and they found radioactive fallout in Oklahoma and all over America. Well, there it is. And then on the 24th of March, it's actually starting to circle the whole of the Northern Hemisphere. Well, this is just an indication of where the fallout went when the wind changed from blowing east to the northwest, and this is where the people fled. And children are still living in areas which were evacuated around Chernobyl. The Japanese government has been really obscene in looking after its children. Next. Well, these are just some of the elements. Uranium 238 and 235, 234, all of which are very carcinogenic, causing congenital deformities and cancer in children in Fallujah and Basra, where they're using uranium weapons. It's really a nuclear war. Here's plutonium, cesium-137, strontium. Cobalt-60 is nasty gear too, really nasty, and its half-life is 5 years more. We've done this more. And this is interesting. This is ginkgos made in hair fern trees just after. This is July the 30th, and it's sort of spring, you know, early summer, and these dead areas on the leaves are where radioactive fallout landed and killed the leaves. These are the azaleas that are all dead. Now, extrapolate that to lungs. Okay? Arne worked with a man called Mark Kaltofen, and you can find this on Arne's website or my website too. And they took engine filters from cars in Tokyo and measured the radiation in them. And the filters were so radioactive, they were brought to America, they had to be buried in radioactive waste dumps. Now, an engine filter is the same as a lung, and it inhales almost about the same amount of air per day as does a lung. They found 10 hot spots in lungs in people in Tokyo, hot spots, plutonium. They measured them here in Seattle, 5 per day. And the thing that's so sad is you see no cancer when it arises, when you cough up your first bit of blood and you think, oh, shit, no. So you go to the doctor and the x-ray is taken and there's a mass. Doesn't wear a sign denoting its origin. Doesn't say, I was made by some plutonium you inhaled from Fukushima 10 years ago. So we can't identify the etiology of a particular cancer. All we can do is take an exposed population, which we did with Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the Marshall Islands and the like, and compare them to a non-exposed group.
Do you want to take some questions?
Yeah.
So the cloud that you showed at the dispersion path, yeah. Are we still okay. Getting that on a regular basis?
Not very much at all, although Arnie says it's still emitting a million curies a day, I think. We need to ask him. A lot's still getting out. However, if there's another earthquake and Building 4 collapses, which contains the cooling pool with fresh fuel, I'm going to evacuate my family from Boston. And they will have to evacuate Tokyo.
From where? Where are you going?
Australia, love. CO2 air masses don't mix at the equator, so the northern hemisphere just gets a fallout. And if there's another earthquake, oh, that's if there's another. But also now the corium, which is the molten lava of the meltdowns, is on the concrete floor, and it can react with the concrete to form hydrogen. In fact, it's doing that as we speak, and they're injecting nitrogen at great rate into the three reactors, unit 1, 2, and 3, to remove the hydrogen so it won't explode. The other thing Arnie explained to me is you get radiolytic decomposition of water. So the radiation splits the water atom into hydrogen and oxygen, a very volatile explosive compound. So we're still at great risk. The accident is not over. There's no way to clean it up. They say 40 years, but they can't clean it up. They can't. And God help us. We don't, I mean, it's not over. This is a study I commissioned called Carbon Free Nuclear Free. There's enough wind power west of the Mississippi to supply your whole country with 3 times the electricity you currently use. You waste 28% of the electricity you use. Nuclear power generates 20%. Turn off all your lights, your computers. Don't hang your clothes, don't dry your clothes in clothes dryers. Hang them outside in the sun. Oh, but Mrs. Brown might see your underpants and your brassiers. Oh, and in the winter, hang them up by the furnace. I mean, just be sensible. Don't walk through those doors without them closed. They're global warming doors. Okay, here's your country. And this was just done by the Natural Resources Defense Council. These are all the reactors you've got. And that's only a 10-mile exclusion zone surrounding them. But in Japan, the American military demanded that the American citizens have to evacuate 50 miles from Fukushima. But, of course, it wasn't enough. So I just wanted to give you an image of what you're dealing with. And from a medical perspective, or I would say it's medically indicated to close all of those reactors down tomorrow. And I don't care what laws they've got or what the NRC says. Laws are not written in stone, and we are the bosses. We are the bosses, the physicians. We understand, and we, only we, have the authority and credibility to close these carcinogenic factories down, which will, over time, from radioactive waste, produce random, compulsory genetic engineering for the rest of time. Okay? Thanks.
Thank you.
This is Anita with the Wise Women Media Radio Show. I want to thank you for listening, and please come back next week, same time, same place, Friday night at 11 p.m. Eastern until 1 a.m. We'll have an exciting new show for you. Thank you again. See us at wisewomenmedia.posteris.com and hit us up at the WePay link to help keep our show on the air. Good night, everyone.